The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us. If not now, tell me when. And miracles do happen every shining now and then. If not now, tell me when. If not now, if not now, tell me when.
Morning. Kerry Newcomer reminds us in this morning's prelude, we may never see this moment of grace and time again. So if we feel something needs to be done, and something needs to change, she raises the question, if not now, tell me when. But you know, beyond our conscious efforts to bring about change, time and the times have a way of changing things for us, sometimes for entire communities, for entire nations. Happens to our holidays as well as other things. Think about the origins and evolution of Memorial Day. In 1868, General John A. Logan declared a day to, quote, decorate the graves of soldiers killed in the American Civil War. 20 years later, the name of the day was changed to Memorial Day. And by the way, how many of you have heard people, as you were growing up, refer to holidays, the holiday we celebrate tomorrow, as Decoration Day? I guess we're dating ourselves, but that's it, right? In 1950, the U.S. Congress passed a resolution requesting that the President of the United States issue a proclamation urging all Americans to observe Memorial Day by uniting in prayer for permanent peace. And in 1971, President Richard Nixon declared Memorial Day a national holiday. We think of the day as an occasion to remember and honor all fallen soldiers, of course, not just those who perished in the Civil War. And for many of us, Memorial Day is a day to remember and honor not only fallen soldiers, but all those whose lives were taken as a direct result of military conflicts. And why not? You see what's going on in Ukraine currently. And we know, for example, that in World War II, at least three times as many civilians as military personnel lost their lives. The estimates go as high as five times. In my family, on Memorial Day, we also pay tribute to all those who worked and sacrificed to build our lives. Used to go to my grandfather's grave and lay flowers and say a prayer. But regardless of who we memorialize on Memorial Day, we're faced with the questions of why and what to remember and how best to honor them. What meaning, what value and importance do we attach to their lives and to their deaths? This morning, our guest speaker, Reverend Dr. Christopher Antell, will help us unpack questions like these. And I'm Jerry Lazzaro. I chair the worship committee here at the Thomas Paine Fellowship. On behalf of the committee and the fellowship as a whole, I welcome all of you. And Reverend Antell, whoever you are, wherever you may be on your spiritual journey, your life's journey, whatever you must in conscience truly, responsibly believe, however you identify or express your gender, whomever you love, whoever loves you, we welcome you, and we invite you to join us in worship this morning, beginning with a responsive reading. This is a reading of a poem by the esteemed American poet and World War I veteran, Archibald MacLeish, and his poem reminds us of the awesome responsibility we have to draw meaning from the lives of those who gave their lives for us. Let's do this a little differently. I want you to read the lines in plain type, and I'll read the lines in italics. Okay, so you will begin the young dead soldiers.
Young dead soldiers do not speak.
Nevertheless, they are heard in the still houses. Who has not heard them?
They have silence and speaks to them in writing and from the house.
They say, We were young. We have died. Remember us.
This day, we have done our brothers and brothers finished, it is not done.
They say we have given our lives, but until it is finished, no one can know what our lives gave.
They say our deaths are not ours, they are yours. They will be what you gave them.
They say whether our lives and our deaths were for peace and a new hope or for nothing, we cannot say. It is you who must say this.
They say,
we were young, they say. We have died. Remember us. It's time to light our chalice. The chalice and the flame together form the symbol of our free faith. They signify, among other things, our openness to the wisdom of many ages and many traditions, and our commitment to keep the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, and the flame of liberty and justice burning within ourselves and throughout our world. And this morning, we may think of this flame as the candles that people of many faiths light to remember those who've passed on, and even the so-called eternal flames burning at the gravesite of fallen heroes, like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and our leaders like John F. Kennedy. And we light our chalice this morning with words by Reverend Charles Flagg, minister, writer, and photographer, who passed away in February of this year. In honor of those we have known and loved in the past, in recognition of the gifts and sacrifices they have made on our behalf, and in our sincere hopes that we may be worthy of their memory, we light our candles, we give our thanks, we offer our prayers. And as we light our peace lamp this morning, let's do it in the spirit of the resolution passed by Congress in 1951, urging us to pray on Memorial Day for a lasting peace. May peace be with us. I think it's time we sing. Our gathering song this morning is a prayer of supplication to let our spiritual home be a house of peace. UU troubadour Jim Scott wrote the words and music, and Michael Tacey leads us in singing hymn number 1054, Let This Be a House of Peace. Thank you.
May vision for our children be our common theme. Let this be our a myth in northern legend, our true of ancient story and cradle of a tender dream. Let this be a house.
If those young at heart want to come forward, I have a little story for us this morning. It's a fable, and I can actually use a couple people here to help me with this. Thank you, Ryan. Cindy? Hey. How you doing? Okay, well, just grab a seat here. You can sit right there, all right? Okay. Do you think you're a peaceful person? Yeah. Would you rather be at peace with others or fight with them? Peace, right, okay, yeah. So you're actually part of this story, okay, all right, because this is about peacekeepers. And one day, the most peaceful inhabitants of the earth asked one very powerful wizard to stop all the wars and all the bloodshed on the planet. All right. Now, before we go on with this story, I got to have a little warning here. I need to remind you that sometimes wizards, though they're very powerful, are not actually all that smart, just like our leaders. And they don't often consider the results of their actions. Well, so the wizard thought about this, and he said, it's simple. I will destroy all the weapons on the planet. And no one will be able to fight anymore. What do you think happened? Oh, the people said, I'd be great. Okay, there was peace on Earth for about 3 days. While the majority of those who were prone to fight looked for and couldn't find their old weapons, so they looked at the young trees and said, we can make spears of them, right? Okay. So they made spears of young trees, and they started to fight again. Well, the wizard got news of this, right? And he said, not to worry, not to worry. I will destroy all young trees, and so the fighting will end. And what do you think happened? After 2 or 3 days of uselessly searching for young trees suitable for making spears, the people who wanted to fight started to cut giant trees and make batons out of them. You know, all right? And the fighting started all over again. So what did the wizard do? He destroyed all the big trees. Okay. Well, what do you think happened? The people wanted to fight started to make knives and swords out of metal. So what do you think the wizard did? Remember, he's not all that bright. Yeah, he destroyed all the metal, right? Okay, all right. So next thing you know, people made slingshots, and they started to sling stones at each other, right? So the wizard destroyed all the stones, too, right? Well, now the peacekeepers really began to worry. They said, wait a minute, all the trees are gone. All the metal and stones are gone. How are we going to live? What are we going to do? How are we going to eat, right? I mean, there'll be no vegetation soon. And people, we're going to die without even fighting. Right? Now, this isn't it. Well, the wizard was pretty puzzled and confused. And he said, I do not know what to do now. I would have destroyed all the people, but even I know that's not such a great idea. And besides, it's not in my power. Right? So the peacekeepers, they sat there like you, silent. They were really down. They didn't know what to do. And in the silence, all of a sudden, they heard a little voice. It was the voice of a young child. How old are you? Yeah. That's exactly the age that this child was. Okay. All right. And said, I have an idea. Why don't we let people feel how others feel when they hurt them? If you hurt someone, you feel the same pain. Or if they bring joy to others, they'll feel the same joy. So no one will want to hurt each other because they'll feel the pain immediately and would have to stop. Well, the people were really overjoyed at this and pretty inspired by this thought, right? And the wizard was a little embarrassed. He hadn't thought of it, right? But he waved his wand, right? And all the trees, the stones, and the metals were restored, right? And everyone on earth felt the pain and joy they caused others. And from that day on, nobody on the planet tried to hurt their neighbor because they would have to feel the same pain too. And people began to help each other more because they liked the sense of joy they felt when they helped someone. And they began to live in joy, in harmony, and in peace. What do you think of that? You think it would work? You think people would find a way to even screw that up? Probably. Well, we could hope if we could. You know what that feeling is? It's called empathy. You know that? You ever heard that word? It's when we can feel what other people feel. And if we had that kind of empathy that resided in everyone on earth, maybe there wouldn't be so much fighting, right? Maybe there wouldn't be so much bloodshed on the planet, huh? Maybe, yeah. We can only hope. And that's one of the reasons we come here, because we have faith in the goodness of people and hope that eventually they'll figure out how to live better together, no? Yeah. Okay. All right. You want to go off to your classes now? Okay, let's sing them all. Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go. Mike, back on. I turn the pulpit over now to Reverend Dr. Christopher Antout, who has a link to this occasion and to our congregation. Reverend Chris Antout is a Unitarian Universalist minister who serves as a staff chaplain at the Veterans Administration Medical Center in Philadelphia. He led worship for us here at TPUF in October of 2018. Chris earned his Doctor of Divinity degree, ministry degree, right? From Hartford Seminary, where our former minister, Reverend Larry Pierce, was one of his professors. Chris's dissertation was based on a moral injury group he launched and led with Peter Yeoman, a staff psychologist. Chris spoke about the moral injury group at the 2017 annual conference of the International Society of Traumatic Stress Studies, and at the VA Center of Excellence for Research on Returning War Veterans. At the 2018 UUA General Assembly, he delivered a presentation titled Moral Injury, The War Inside. Reverend Antel will share a reading with us and then deliver his message, Remembering Well on Memorial Day.
Thank you, Jerry. I'm not a wizard. I love the story. The reading I'm going to share comes from our Creating Peace Statement of Conscience, which is a Unitarian Universalist statement passed at our General Assembly in 2010. And the part I've selected to share with you is confessional. It goes like this. Our faith calls us to create peace Yet we confess that we have not done all we could to create peace in ourselves, our congregations, our society, or to prevent the spread of armed conflict throughout the world. Our faith calls us to respect diverse points of view. Yet we confess too often we have allowed our disagreements to distract us from all we can do together. At times we have lacked the courage to speak and act against violence and injustice. At times we have lacked the creativity to speak and act in constructive ways. At times we have condemned the violence of others without acknowledging our own complicity in violence. Well, it's good to be back with the congregation here at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I appreciate Jerry for his opening words, the touching reading that we shared by Archibald MacLeish, but also his invitation to consider Memorial Day more expansively. A reminder that Jerry gave us when he told us that three times the number of civilians died in World War II than combatants. And I took from the wizard's story a reminder that with all this talk of peace, and it's been said a lot this morning already, we also need to talk about pain. And empathy. So part of my task this morning may be to disturb the peace and create what one author has called empathic unsettlement. So I want to warn the congregation this morning, both in person and online, that the content I'm inviting us to explore might be painful, might be troubling. And includes conversations about violence and our relationship to violence. And for some people, it could be triggering. Things may come up, it could be overwhelming. I work for the Department of Veterans Affairs. This morning, I come to you as a clergyman in our tradition, and what I have to say in no ways represents the U.S. government or the Department of Veterans Affairs. That being said, for veterans in our community, either in person or online, this morning, the Veterans Crisis Line is 988 and Veterans press 1 if you find yourself in need of additional support. And that 988 number works for anyone. I'm leaving abruptly today after the service. Please don't take that to mean I don't like you. In fact, I'll be leaving so quickly, I'm wearing my running shoes under this robe. And that's because I have another engagement. However, I recognize that the content that we're exploring here can be evocative and provocative. And some of you, I hope all of us, we'll need some time to reflect. So you have in your email box an invitation to a Zoom meeting with me at 3 p.m. this afternoon. Feel free to do other things, but I'll be available for anyone who wants to come into that Zoom room and process and reflect together with me about the content of our service today. The trauma psychiatrist Judith Herman, who wrote a famous book called Trauma and Recovery and recently published a new book called Truth and Repair, now talks about four stages of recovery. And I bring up Judith Herman because war and thinking and reflecting seriously about the costs and consequences of our wars involves pain and trauma. So as we venture into this area, if you don't want to be in this area this morning, no judgment, you're free to leave from this room physically. I won't take it personally. If you're online, feel free to turn off your camera to go do something else. But I want to offer to you these stages of recovery so we can keep a framework in mind as we venture into the midst of pain. How do we recover? We don't want to get stuck. So Judith Herman talks about the importance of safety, remembrance and mourning, and we're going to move into that. Reconnection. And in her new book, she talks about a fourth stage, justice, working for justice. So as we remember and perhaps mourn together this morning, let's also remember we're in a safe place, relatively speaking. If you're online, have someone to reach out to, your own safety person. We're in community, an opportunity to connect and reconnect. And we're in a community that works for justice. So in fact, we're quite well placed to do the work of not only paying attention to trauma, but also moving through recovery. Remembering well on Memorial Day is, I will argue, present the task of the church, the faith community, generally, ours specifically. And I want to distinguish two kinds of remembering. And this comes from a German theologian who's reflected on his own country's history with the Holocaust and his own complicity and his own responsibility. Geiko Müller-Fahrenholz talks about selective remembering and deep remembering. And he says selective remembering is a way of rereading history that looks at national victories without counting the damage done, that is, without contemplating the guilt involved. Selective remembering produces ideologies of denial and suppression and needs to demonize the other to preserve its own purity and sense of mission. Now, he contrasts this to what he calls deep remembering. Grateful for genuine greatness, his words again, but does not shun guilt and suppression, rejoices at human inventiveness and ingenuity, but also shares in the many forms of suffering. Deep remembering is about transforming the art of the possible and makes the possible possible. So I'm inviting us into the work of deep remembering. In a culture where around this time of year, Memorial Day, Memorial Day weekend, there's a lot of selective remembering going on, if there's any remembering at all. On the way here this morning, I passed an Episcopal church and there were many flags staked in the grass along the road, a big flag hanging right outside the entrance to the church. And I was reminded of the reason why I'm not Episcopalian. I have nothing against flags. I think there's a conversation and some deep thinking that needs to be had when we start bringing flags into our churches and synagogues and mosques, either hanging out front or perhaps on the chancel. So I felt some concern. I wasn't surprised. And then when I arrived here, I felt some relief that you didn't do that. And maybe someone wanted to, and there was arguments, but we don't need to get into that. I'm glad I'm not Episcopalian, but I kind of wished I was giving the message at that Episcopalian church this morning. So I don't need to close my eyes when I leave. But let's do this, because it's appropriate to remember and mourn the young dead soldiers, the young dead Marines, airmen and women, sailors. Let's do that now. And this may become uncomfortable for some of you, because I'm inviting a focused reflection, not generally of any veteran who's ever been in the military. I'm asking us to think about people we know who've died in war while serving in the US military. And if you can think of one person right now, I invite you to rise. And that's an open invitation. If you're able-bodied and you can stand, I invite you to stand. If you'd like to raise your arms, but rise. Give some indication this morning that you're connected to a person who's died while serving in the US military in a time of war. Please remain standing. Please remain standing. And I'd like to invite, if you feel so moved, to speak aloud, or if you're joining virtually, to type into the chat the name or names of the person or people that you're remembering now. Just the name. Please remain standing if you've risen. Please stay. I'm going to expand it to the invitation. If you're able to remember, to recall the name or even a face of a person, anywhere in the world who's died in military conflict, either combatant or non-combatant from this country or from any place, if you're able to picture that person, to name that person, please rise. It could even be in history, somebody you read about, something you read in the newspaper. If you'd like to speak that name or those names aloud now, I invite you to do that.
Owen Wilford Owen.
Let's just sit with this moment of discomfort and stand if you're standing. What does it mean that we've been in a country that's been at war for decades, perhaps? Some of our entire lifetime, but we cannot name a person who's died in these wars. What does it say about our privilege? What does it say about our engagement, our awareness, our denial, our suppression? Please be seated. A candle for the young dead soldiers. For everyone else. As we read Archibald MacLeish this morning, I was thinking of Job Price. He was 42 when he died in Afghanistan. I was one of the chaplains providing support at his dignified transfer on the flight line in Afghanistan in 2012. He's from Pottstown. Up the road. Preceding his death, four others from his command, because Job was an officer, a SEAL team leader, had died. Kashif Memon, Clinton Ruiz, I was on the flight line for them, standing beside Commander Price. Then Matthew Cantor, and finally, Kevin Ebert. And perhaps it was his personal connection to Kevin. We don't know. We'll never know. But the official report is that Job Price shot himself in the head. I remember the dignified transfer ceremony and sending his casket back to Delaware to his wife and children on Christmas Eve, 2012. Brandon Buttrey was the youngest of the 27 dead soldiers I provided a dignified transfer service for. He was 19. So this is one task of the church on Memorial Day, to remember these names, these people, to acknowledge their death, to provide grief support to survivors, to comfort the afflicted. It's an important role, and it's a significant one of the faith community. But if we stop there, we remember selectively, and our challenge is to remember well and to move towards deep remembering. Deep remembering in a congregation, in a religious community, involves the work of theological reflection. It involves the work of practical theology. And that is simply asking ourselves four questions. What is happening, or what has happened? The descriptive task. What's going on? Why is it going on? The interpretive task. What ought to be going on? The normative task. And what do we do next? The pragmatic task. And this is a process of not just remembering, but of theologically reflecting, that can move us through these stages of trauma and recovery towards action, towards reconnection, and towards justice. And we have, especially true in our Unitarian Universalist tradition, a prophetic imperative, as Richard Gilbert calls it, or as James Luther Adams preached, the prophethood of all believers. Paul Razor, Unitarian theologian, in this book, calls us to reclaim our prophetic witness. So there is this pastoral role, but there's also a prophetic task, prophetic role. And the prophetic role of the church, I dare say, on any church, any congregation in the United States, any religious community that calls itself religious, is to remember deeply, to learn about and reckon with the full cost of our wars and military service on people in the planet, not just here in the United States, but everywhere, especially among the marginalized, the disenfranchised, the economically destitute, in the communities farthest from justice and the reaches of the tribal regions of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq, and into the flames of Auschwitz, Treblinka, Dresden, Tokyo, Hiroshima. The prophetic task of the church within our Unitarian Universalist tradition extends even further. We are morally obligated, through our covenantal commitment, to affirm and promote principles. A responsible search for truth, justice, equity, and compassion. And through our statements of conscience, like creating peace. We explored a bit of that this morning. We are morally obligated, I offer to you, to do three things. First is to confront the psychological processes that sabotage our prophetic mission. Processes like denial and self-deception and mechanisms of moral disengagement that Albert Bandura has written about. Dehumanization, displacement of responsibility, euphemistic labeling. All of the ways we distance ourselves psychologically from our complicity and our moral accountability for suffering. So the first task in the prophetic imperative is to confront these psychological processes in ourselves and in others. Second, we need to differentiate ourselves and our culture, our tradition, our religious heritage from the cultures we inhabit. What peace educator Johann Galtung calls the structural and cultural violence, often concealed, often invisible, that feed the direct violence that manifests itself in the use of military force. This culture includes theological elements. Robert Bellah called it civil religion. Jeremy Gunn, more recently, described it as American national religion, a conflation of government theism, a commitment to military supremacy, and an understanding of capitalism as freedom. This is the American national religion. And it can seep into the walls of our congregations, especially on days like this. Walter Wink names the theology as a theology of redemptive violence. This is the idea that violence deployed by good people will save us from violence in the hands of bad people. And if the church is not vigilant and differentiating ourselves from this war culture, this militarism, this American national religion, and if we fail to repudiate this theology, then we fail in our prophetic task and become nothing more than the collaborator and enabler, complicit in sanctifying war culture, concealing U.S. violence in the cloak of piety. And the final task, and I'm going to end here, is to live in the presence of burning children. Yes, burning children. Rabbi Irving Greenberg wrote what has become known as the Greenberg Dictum in his own reflection theologically on the Holocaust in an essay called Pillar of Fire, Cloud of Smoke. And he says this: the cruelty and the killing raise the question of whether even those who believe after such an event dare talk about God who loves and cares without making a mockery of those who suffered. Let us offer then as a working principle the following: no statement, theological or otherwise, should be made that would not be credible in the presence of burning children. So what might it mean to do church in the presence of burning children? Might mean naming them, some of them, the ones who've burned in hellfire, the hellfire of our own creation, manufactured by Northrop Grumman in Orlando, Florida, sold for $150,000 a piece to the US government and dropped in the tens and thousands over the last two decades. It's called the Hellfire Missile. And it was the Hellfire Missile that killed Sumaya and her sister, two-year-old sister, in the last act, military act of the Afghanistan war, a drone strike on August 29th in Kabul that left seven children dead, 10 total, all civilians. So I found another truth, different than our universalist tradition. You've heard it said that there's no hellfire preached in our pulpits, that a loving God will spare us from the flames and burns. But I say to you, there's another truth. All souls do not escape the burn of this hellfire. And those whom our bombs and missiles destroy are burned in body. And we who carefully examine ourselves, our conscience, and our complicity may find ourselves burned in soul, as I do. In the presence of burning children, so too our consciences ought to burn. So we do church in the presence of burning children, remembering them, sharing responsibility for their deaths, so we may harness the power to create a better world where no people ever burn again in the hellfire of our own creation. Thank you.
Well, that's a sobering message. It is. And we've now come to that time in our service where we open the floor for joys and concerns. If you're experiencing a joy lifting your spirit up or a sorrow weighing your spirit down, we invite you after a brief musical interlude, and you can share it with us. Our closing song this morning is another prayer for peace, set to the tune of Jean Sibelius's hymn tune, Finlandia. American poet, illustrator, and composer Lloyd Stone wrote the lyrics, and this song setting takes a tune considered, this is a very, it just perfectly matches, I think we're saying, this song setting takes a tune considered the national anthem of one country, in this case, Sibelius's homeland, Finland, and urges us to look beyond nationalism and tribalism to a universalism of experience and sentiment. In a way, it sings of a world, of the world envisioned in that story this morning, right? Where we recognize and empathize with peoples of all nations and can understand our connection with them. So this is my song, hymn number 159. But never, never the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, the flame of liberty and justice. And this morning, too, you never extinguish the memory of those who have suffered as a result of violence on this earth, and a reminder to keep that flame of commitment burning in our hearts, to do whatever we can to somehow mitigate the harm that occurs because of it.
The people, young and old, everywhere, who've died in these armed conflicts, whether our lives and our deaths were for peace and a new hope, or for nothing, we cannot say. It is we who must say. Friends, this has been a hard message to hear.
Thank you, Chris. If you can, would you please stay for announcements? And I believe Lindy is going to present them this morning.